Chapter 56. The Frog Speech. At Chequers, despite the late hour, Churchill began dictating at once. His plan, to speak directly to the French public, in both English and French, in a broadcast from the BBC's new radio studio at the Cabinet War Rooms in London. Uneasy about the possibility that the Vichy government, in charge of unoccupied France, might formally ally its armed forces with Germany's, Churchill hoped to assure French people everywhere, including in France's colonies, that England was wholly on their side, and to rouse them to acts of resistance. For the time being, to his great frustration, he could offer nothing more. He proposed to write the French version himself. He dictated slowly, without notes. Pug Ismay stayed with him, the hoped-for early bedtime lost. Churchill spoke for 2 hours, well into Sunday morning. He notified the Ministry of Information that he planned to make his broadcast the following night, Monday, October 21st, and would speak for a total of 20 minutes, 10 in French, 10 in English. "Make all necessary arrangements," he directed. On Monday, while still at Chequers, he continued working on the speech, still intent on drafting the French version himself, but finding the going harder than his ego had led him to expect. The Ministry of Information dispatched to Chequers a young staff member with an academic competence in French to translate the text, but the man made no headway. He was terrified, according to John Peck, the private secretary on duty at Chequers that day. The would-be translator found himself confronting a prime minister who had again changed his mind and was trying anew to work up his own French draft, and was adamant about doing so. The young man was shipped back to London. The ministry sent a new translator, Michel Saint-Denis, a charming, avuncular, truly bilingual Frenchman, unearthed from the BBC, according to Peck. Churchill acknowledged the man's obvious expertise and relented. By now, Churchill had begun referring to the text as his frog speech, frog being an unhappy nickname for a Frenchman. The speech was of sufficient importance that Churchill actually rehearsed it. Ordinarily, this would have drawn forth his streak of stubborn childishness, but translator Saint-Denis, to his relief, encountered a tolerant, mostly obedient Prime Minister. Churchill had difficulty with certain French linguistic manoeuvres, in particular rolling his R's, but Saint-Denis found him to be a willing student, later recalling he relished the flavour of some words as though he was tasting fruit. Churchill and Saint-Denis drove to London. The speech was now scheduled for 9 o'clock that night. This being the BBC's accustomed news hour, Churchill was guaranteed a vast listenership in England and France, and, via illicit radios, in Germany. An air raid was underway when Churchill, wearing his pale blue siren suit, left 10 Downing Street to head for the war rooms, followed by various staff members and Saint-Denis. Ordinarily, the walk was a pleasant one, but the Luftwaffe once again seemed to be targeting government buildings. Searchlights sabred the sky, illuminating the condensation trails of bombers above. Anti-aircraft guns blasted away, sometimes with a single report, sometimes a brisk sequence, at 2 rounds a second. The shells exploded far overhead, showering the streets with steel splinters that whistled as they fell. Churchill walked briskly. His translator ran to keep up. Inside the BBC's broadcast chamber, Churchill settled in to begin his speech. The room was cramped, with a single armchair, a desk, and a microphone. The translator, Saint-Denis, was to introduce him to listeners, but found he had no place to sit. "On my knees," Churchill said. He leaned back and patted his thigh. Wrote Saint-Denis, "I inserted a leg between his, and next moment had seated myself partly on the arm of the chair, and partly on his knee." "Frenchmen," Churchill began, "for more than 30 years, in peace and war, I have marched with you, and I am marching still along the same road. Britain, too, was under attack," he said, referring to the nightly air raids. He assured his audience that "our people are bearing up unflinchingly. Our air force has more than held its own. We are waiting for the long-promised invasion. So are the fishes." What followed was a plea for the French to take heart and not make things worse by impeding Britain's fight. This clearly a reference to Dakar. Hitler was the true enemy, Churchill stressed. This evil man, this monstrous abortion of hatred and defeat, is resolved on nothing less than the complete wiping out of the French nation. and the disintegration of its whole life and future. Churchill urged resistance, including within so-called unoccupied France, another reference to Vichy-administered territory. "Frenchmen," he declaimed, "rearm your spirits before it is too late." He promised that he and the British Empire would never give up until Hitler was beaten. "Good night, then," he said. "Sleep to gather strength for the morning will come." At Chequers, Mary listened with great pride. "Tonight Papa spoke to France," she wrote in her diary, "so frankly, so encouragingly, so nobly and tenderly. I hope his voice reached many of them, and that its power and richness will have brought them new hope and faith." She felt moved to inscribe in her diary the chorus to La Marseillaise, in French, which begins, "Aux armes, citoyens," to arms, citizens. "Dear France," she ended, "so great and glorious, be worthy of your noblest song, and of that right cause you twice bled for, liberty." In the cabinet war rooms, when the broadcast came to an end, there was silence. "Nobody moved," translator Saint-Denis recalled. "We were deeply stirred." Then Churchill stood up. His eyes were full of tears. Churchill said, "We have made history tonight." In Berlin, a week later, Goebbels began his morning meeting by bemoaning the fact that the German public appeared to be listening to the BBC on an increasing scale. He ordered heavy sentences for radio offenders and told his propaganda lieutenants that every German must be clear in his mind that listening in to these broadcasts represents an act of serious sabotage. As it happened, according to an RAF report summarizing intelligence gathered from captured Luftwaffe airmen, this injunction, in the long run, worked in the opposite sense to that which was intended. It produced an irresistible urge to listen to them. Chapter 57. The Ovipositor. Election night, November 5th, was tense on both sides of the Atlantic. The early returns, delivered to Roosevelt at his home in Hyde Park, New York, showed Wilkie doing better than expected. But by 11 p.m., it became clear that Roosevelt would win. "It looks all right," he told a crowd gathered on his lawn. The final tally showed that he had won the popular vote by fewer than 10 percentage points. In the Electoral College, however, he won by a landslide, 449-82. The news brought joy throughout Whitehall. "It is the best thing that has happened to us since the outbreak of war," wrote Harold Nicholson. "I thank God." Upon hearing the results, he said, "My heart leapt like a young salmon." Home intelligence reported that throughout England and Wales, the result has been greeted with overwhelming satisfaction. Mary Churchill, at Chequers, wrote, "Glory, hallelujah." With Roosevelt re-elected, the hoped-for payoff, America joining the war as a full partner, seemed much less distant. Churchill needed the help more than ever. The Chancellor of the Exchequer now informed him that Britain would soon run out of money to pay for the weapons, food, and other aid it needed to survive. Churchill sent his congratulations to Roosevelt in a floridly disingenuous telegram in which he confessed that he had prayed for his victory and was thankful for the outcome. "This does not mean," he wrote, "that I seek or wish for anything more than the full, fair, and free play of your mind upon the world issues now at stake, in which our two nations have to discharge their respective duties." He claimed that he merely looked forward to being able to exchange thoughts about the war. "Things are afoot, which will be remembered as long as the English language is spoken in any quarter of the globe, and in expressing the comfort I feel that the people of the United States have once again cast these great burdens upon you, I must avow my sure faith that the lights by which we steer will bring us all safely to anchor." Roosevelt neither acknowledged the telegram nor replied. This galled Churchill and worried him, though he was reluctant to do anything about it. At last, after nearly 3 weeks, he cabled his ambassador in Washington, Lord Lothian, and with the guardedness of a snubbed suitor, quietly raised the issue. "Would you kindly find out for me most discreetly whether the President received my personal telegram congratulating him on re-election?" he wrote. "It may have been swept up in electioneering congratulations. If not, I wonder whether there was anything in it which could have caught offence or been embarrassing for him to receive." He added, "Should welcome your advice." The prof, at least, provided some good news. In a November 1st, 1940 minute to Churchill, he reported that his aerial mines had finally claimed a victim. This during the first operational test of parachute-tethered mines released from an RAF aircraft in front of Luftwaffe bombers. Radar tracked the German bomber to the curtain of drifting parachutes, at which point the plane's radar echo vanished and did not reappear. Lindemann saw this as proof of success. He did note, however, that there had been a malfunction involving the apparatus through which the mines were expelled, which Lindemann dubbed the ovipositor, borrowing a biological term for the organ an insect or fish uses to deposit its eggs. The failure caused one of the mines to explode against the fuselage of the RAF plane that dropped it, an event that most certainly raised a degree of consternation among the crew, but that otherwise caused no serious damage. Still, the prof worried about how this would affect the Air Ministry's already jaundiced appraisal of the weapon, and he wanted reassurance of Churchill's continued support. He wrote, "I trust this unlikely accident will not be allowed to prejudice immediate continuance of these trials, which seem to have had such an auspicious beginning after so many years." Churchill's faith in the weapon and the prof did not waver. The prof, meanwhile, seemed bent on further vexing the Air Ministry. In late October, he had written to Churchill about something else that had become one of his obsessions, the German navigational beams. The prof saw the development of electronic countermeasures to jam and bend the beams as vital to England's defence, and he believed the Air Ministry was dragging its feet in developing and deploying the needed technologies. He complained to Churchill. Again, invoking his power relay, Churchill took this up immediately and forwarded the prof's minute to Charles Portal, chief of the air staff, who replied with an account of all that had been done, including development of jamming devices and decoy fires set along the paths of beams to trick German pilots into dropping their bombs. These fires were called starfish, owing to their appearance from the air at night, and were proving effective, as gauged by the number of bombs falling into empty fields adjacent to the fires. In one notable case, a decoy fire outside Portsmouth drew 170 high-explosive bombs and 32 parachute mines. With evident irritation, but ever mindful of the prof's special connection to the Prime Minister, Portal wrote, "Professor Lindemann implies in his minute that we are not pressing on with our radio countermeasures to the German beam system as fast as we might. I can assure that this is not the case. The effort, Portal said, is being given the highest possible priority." The prof also inflicted added work on Pug Ismay, who, as Churchill's military chief of staff, already was fully occupied, and appeared to be feeling the strain. This new sally, too, involved navigational beams. On the night of November 6th, a bomber from the Luftwaffe's secretive KGR-100 unit, thought to be expert at flying along beams, went down in the sea off Bridport, on England's Channel coast, mostly intact and very near shore. A Navy salvage squad wanted to retrieve the bomber while it was still readily accessible, but Army officials claimed it was their jurisdiction, the result being that the Army did not make any attempt to secure it, and the heavy seas soon wrecked the aircraft, according to an RAF intelligence report on the incident, which was sent to Lindemann. The prof made sure that Churchill knew about the debacle. In a note with the RAF report attached, he sniffed, "It is a very great pity that inter-service squabbles resulted in the loss of this machine, which is the first of its kind to come within our grasp." Churchill promptly dispatched a personal minute to Pug Ismay on the matter, saying, "Pray make proposals to ensure that in future, immediate steps are taken to secure all possible information and equipment from German aircraft which come down in this country or near our coasts, and that these rare opportunities are not squandered through departmental differences." Which was, of course, just exactly what Ismay needed to make his day complete. Ismay relayed this to the chiefs of staff, who reviewed the existing protocols for handling downed aircraft. The airplane had been lost, Ismay told Churchill, through a stupidly rigid interpretation of these orders. He assured Churchill that new instructions were being issued and that safeguarding downed aircraft was of paramount importance. He noted, in closing, that the radio equipment the RAF had most hoped to salvage from the bomber had ultimately been washed up from the wreckage and recovered. Lost in this acerbic interchange was the reason why this plane had crash-landed in the first place. Thanks to continued prodding by the Prof and the inventive attentions of Dr. R.V. Jones and the RAF's No. 80 Wing Countermeasures Unit, as well as deft interrogation of captured German airmen, the RAF now knew of the existence of the Luftwaffe's X system of navigation, enough to build transmitters, codenamed Bromides, capable of redirecting, meekening the system's beams. The first such transmitter had been installed 5 days before the German bomber's flight. The bomber's crew, flying at night through heavily overcast skies, had expected to pick up their designated guidance beam over the Bristol Channel, between England and Wales, and then to follow it to their target, a factory in Birmingham, but they could not find the signal. To proceed without the beam, with such bad visibility, would have been foolhardy, so the pilot decided to change the plan and instead bomb the dockyards in Bristol. He hoped that by descending beneath the clouds, he would find a visual landmark to establish his new course. But the cloud ceiling was very low, and visibility under it was extremely poor due to darkness and weather. The pilot, Hans Lehmann, realized that he was lost. Soon, however, his wireless operator began picking up strong signals from the Luftwaffe's standard radio beacon at St. Malo on the Brittany coast. Lehmann decided to turn around and use this to help guide him back to his base. When he reached St. Malo, he reported his position and the course he would now follow. Contrary to standard practice, he received neither a confirmation that his message had been received nor the usual landing instructions. Lehmann continued on and began his descent, hoping soon to be able to see familiar terrain below. But he found only water. On the assumption that he had overshot his airfield, he turned around and tried another approach. By now he was low on fuel. His bomber had been aloft and lost for over 8 hours. Lehmann decided that his only option now was to beach the plane on the French coast. Visibility was so poor that he landed instead in the sea, near the shore. He and two other crewmen managed to reach dry ground, but the fourth failed to appear. Lehmann thought he had landed in France, perhaps on the Bay of Biscay. Instead, he had put the plane down just off the Dorset coast of England. What he had believed to be the St. Malo guide point was in fact an RAF masking beacon transmitted by a meekening station in the village of Templecombe in Somerset, England, 35 miles south of Bristol. Lehmann and his men were promptly captured and shipped off to an RAF interrogation centre outside London, where Air Intelligence was delighted to learn that they were members of the mysterious KGR 100. Chapter 58. Our Special Source. England's weather degraded. Gales raked the landscape and roiled the surrounding seas, making an amphibious landing by German forces seem less and less likely. Fragments of intelligence from Bletchley Park, which Air Ministry officials referred to only as our special source, suggested that Hitler might have postponed his planned Operation Sea Lion. Yet the Luftwaffe continued to pummel London with nightly raids, and now appeared to be expanding its range of targets elsewhere in England. Clearly, something new was afoot, and the implications were troubling. London had shown itself able to withstand nightly attack, but how would the rest of the country fare, as more and more civilians were killed or injured and bombed from their homes? The details of the Luftwaffe's new campaign were starting to come into focus. On Tuesday, November 12th, intelligence officers listened in as a newly captured German airman conversed with another prisoner in a room fitted with a hidden microphone. "He believes," the officers reported, "that riots have broken out in London, and that Buckingham Palace has been stormed, and that Hermann," a reference to Luftwaffe chief Hermann Göring, "thinks the psychological moment has come for a colossal raid to take place between the 15th and the 20th of this month, at the full moon, and that Coventry and Birmingham will be the towns attacked." The scenario described by the prisoner was chilling. For this raid, the Luftwaffe planned to deploy every available bomber and use every navigational beam. The planes would carry 50-kilogram, 110-pound, shrieking bombs. The prisoner, according to the report, said the bombers were to concentrate on destroying working-class neighbourhoods, where the populace was believed to be on the verge of revolt. The report cautioned that the new prisoner might not be very reliable and recommended that his remarks be treated with circumspection. What had prompted Air Intelligence to relay them now, the report said, was its receipt that afternoon of information from the special source that indicated the Germans were planning a gigantic raid, codenamed Moonlight Sonata. The special source believed the target was not Coventry or Birmingham, but rather London. The attack would likely take place 3 days hence, on Friday, November 15th, when the moon was full, and would involve up to 1,800 German aircraft, including bombers from KGR 100, the elite firestarter unit, whose incendiaries would further light the target. One indication of the singular importance of the raid was the fact that Goering himself planned to direct the operation. If all this was true, it raised the spectre of the massive knockout raid, Churchill's aerial banquet, that civil defence officials had expected and feared ever since the start of the war. The Air Ministry circulated a minute sheet, on which officials offered their thoughts about the bits of intelligence known thus far. In an entry marked "Most Secret," an RAF wing commander wrote that the exact date of the raid would probably be signalled by a flight in the afternoon by bombers from KGR 100. Their goal would be to check on weather conditions over the selected target and make sure the navigational beams were positioned properly. He proposed that the word sonata might itself be significant. In music, sonatas were traditionally structured around three movements. This suggested that the attack might occur in three phases. The exact target was still not clear, but intercepted instructions showed that the Luftwaffe had selected four possible areas, among them London. The information in hand was deemed reliable enough to cause Air Ministry officials to begin planning a response. A counter-operation intended to pour cold water on the German attack began to take shape. Appropriately enough, it was codenamed Cold Water. One official proposed that the best response, from the point of view of the British public, would be to launch a massive RAF strike against a target in Germany. He suggested a big bang on targets along the Ruhr River, or even Berlin itself, and recommended as well that the bombs used be fitted with the RAF's version of Germany's Jericho trumpet to make each bomb howl on its way down. "The whistles for our bombs," he noted, "have already gone out to depots, and there should be no trouble in getting them fitted to our 250 and 500-pound bombs for an occasion of this kind. If the Big Bang is to achieve the best model effect, we suggest we should do this." Operation Cold Water also called for the RAF's new countermeasures squadron, No. 80 Wing, established in July, to do all it could to disrupt the skein of navigational beams transmitted by the Germans. Two specially equipped bombers were to fly back along a key beam transmitted from Cherbourg and bomb the transmitter. They would know they were over the target because previous electronic reconnaissance had shown that the beams disappeared directly above the transmitting stations. The RAF referred to this dead space as the silent zone, the cutout, and yes, the cone of silence. No word of the possible German attack as yet was conveyed to Churchill. At 7 o'clock on Wednesday night, Air Intelligence gave RAF commanders a new update on Moonlight Sonata from the special source, which confirmed that the raid would indeed have three parts, though whether these were three phases in one night or over three nights was not clear. The source supplied the code names for two of the three phases, the first being Regenschirm, or Umbrella, the second Mondschein Serenade, or Moonshine Serenade. The name for the third was not yet known. One of the Air Ministry's most senior men, William Sholto Douglas, Deputy Chief of the Air Staff, doubted that the Germans planned an attack over three nights. "How can even the optimistic Bosch hope to get three successive nights of fine weather?" Typically, news about the day-to-day activities of German forces did not get sent to Churchill, but with the scale of the attack expected to be so great, on Thursday, November 14th, the Air Ministry prepared a special, most secret memorandum for the Prime Minister. This, in turn, was placed in his special yellow box, reserved for the most secret messages. As best anyone could tell, the raid would not occur until the next night, Friday, November 15th, which promised to be nearly ideal for flying, with cold, mostly clear skies and a full moon that would light the landscape below to a brightness approaching that of daylight. But this supposition was incorrect, as soon became apparent. At noon on Thursday, Colville made his way to Westminster Abbey, where he was to be an usher at the funeral service for former Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, who had died the week before. Churchill was a pallbearer, as was Halifax. A bomb had blown out the windows of the chapel. There was no heat. Government ministers filled the seats in the choir. Everyone wore coats and gloves, but froze all the same. The chapel was only partly full, owing to the fact that the time and place for the funeral had been kept secret. A prudent measure, Colville noted, for a judiciously placed bomb would have had spectacular results. Colville's gaze fell on Duff Cooper, Minister of Information, whose face bore a look of blank indifference, almost of disdain. A few ministers sang hymns. No sirens wailed. No German aircraft appeared overhead. Later that afternoon, at 10 Downing, Churchill, his detective, his typist, and the rest of his usual weekend platoon walked through the back garden and entered the usual cars. They settled in for the drive to the country, this time to Ditchley, Churchill's full moon house. Just before departure, the private secretary assigned to weekend duty, John Martin, handed Churchill the yellow box containing his most secret communications and joined him in the back seat. The cars set off at high speed and moved west along the Mall, past Buckingham Palace and along the southern border of Hyde Park. A few minutes into the drive, Churchill opened the box and there found a secret memorandum dated that day that described, in three dense pages, a possibly imminent Luftwaffe operation called Moonlight Sonata. The report proceeded to detail what air intelligence had learned and how the RAF planned to respond. It named four possible target areas, with Central London and Greater London mentioned first. The report stated that London seemed the likely choice. Then came the most troubling phrase in the memorandum. The whole of the German long-range bomber force will be employed. The raid, moreover, would be directed, we think, by Hermann Göring himself. The intelligence comes from a very good source indeed. Churchill, of course, knew that this source had to be Bletchley Park. Far more satisfactory were the next two pages of the report, which detailed the RAF's planned response, Operation Cold Water, and stated that RAF Bomber Command would follow a knock-for-knock policy, with bombers concentrating on a single city in Germany, maybe Berlin, but possibly Munich or Essen, the choice to be determined by the weather. By this point, Churchill and his entourage, en route to Ditchley but still within the city, were just passing Kensington Gardens. Churchill ordered his driver to turn around. Wrote Secretary Martin, he was not going to sleep quietly in the country while London was under what was expected to be a heavy attack. The car sped back to 10 Downing Street. So grave was the apparent threat that Churchill ordered his female staff to leave before nightfall and directed them to go home or to the paddock, the fortified emergency headquarters in Dollis Hill. He told John Colville and another private secretary, John Peck, to spend the night at the Down Street Station, a luxurious shelter built by the London Passenger Transport Board that Churchill occasionally occupied. He called it his burrow. Colville did not object. He and Peck dined apolaustically, as Colville put it, using a tenpenny word meaning with great enjoyment. The shelter's stock of luxuries included caviar, Havana cigars, brandy dating to 1865, and, of course, champagne. Perrier Jouet 1928. Churchill went to the cabinet war rooms to await the raid. He did many things well, but waiting was not one of them. Growing impatient, he climbed to the roof of the nearby Air Ministry building to watch for the attack, bringing Pug Ismay with him. Air intelligence at last identified the target. In the afternoon, members of the RAF's radio countermeasures unit detected new beam transmissions from German transmitters in France. Wireless operators listening in on German communications intercepted the expected Luftwaffe advance reconnaissance reports, as well as messages from a control center at Versailles, from which the raid was to be directed. Together, these offered strong evidence that Moonlight Sonata would occur that night, November 14th, a day earlier than intelligence had first suggested. At 6:17 p.m., roughly an hour after sunset, the first German bombers, 13 of them, crossed the southern coast of England at Lyme Bay. These were the bombers of KGR-100, so adept at finding and flying along radio beams. They carried more than 10,000 individual incendiary canisters to illuminate the target for the bombers that soon would follow. A few aircraft did pass over London at 7:15 p.m. and again 10 minutes later, setting off sirens and driving people into shelters. But these aircraft continued on without event, leaving behind a silent city made ghostly by moonlight. As it happened, these were feints, meant to convince the RAF that the big raid was indeed targeting the capital. Chapter 59. A Coventry Farewell. By 3 o'clock that Thursday afternoon, the RAF's radio countermeasures group knew that German navigational beams were intersecting not over London, but above Coventry, a centre for arms manufacturing in the Midlands, nearly 100 miles away. Industry aside, Coventry was best known for its medieval cathedral, and for hosting, according to legend, the drafty 11th century ride of Lady Godiva, and as a by-product, giving rise to the term Peeping Tom, after a man named Thomas was said to defy an edict ordering citizens not to peek at the passing countess. For reasons unclear, the news that Coventry was the intended target was not relayed to Churchill, waiting impatiently on the Air Ministry roof. The RAF's radio countermeasures group struggled to determine the exact frequencies needed to jam or distort the navigational beams aimed toward the city. Only a few jamming transmitters were available, and by now the sky was scored with invisible beams. One beam passed right over Windsor Castle, west of London, prompting concern that the Luftwaffe might have targeted the royal family itself. A warning was relayed to the castle. Air raid precautions, ARP officials, assigned to its defence, manned the battlements, as if awaiting a medieval siege, and they soon saw bombers overhead, black against the nearly full moon, in a procession that seemed endless. No bombs fell. At 5:46 p.m., Coventry entered its blackout period. The moon was already up and visible, having risen at 5:18 p.m. Citizens closed their blackout blinds and curtains. The lights at train stations were turned off. This was routine. But even with the blackout underway, the streets were agleam with light. The moon was dazzling, the sky exceptionally clear. Leonard Dascombe, a tool setter at an arms factory, was on his way to work when he realized how brilliantly it shone, its light glistening from on the housetops. Another man observed that the moon made the headlights on his car unnecessary. "We could almost have read a newspaper, it was such a wonderful night," he said. Lucy Moseley, a daughter of the city's newly elected mayor, John Jack Moseley, recalled, "It really was unnaturally light outside. Hardly ever before or since have I seen such a brilliant November night." As the Moseleys settled in for the evening, a family member called it a huge, really horrible bomber's moon. At 7:05 p.m., an ARP message arrived at the local civil defence control room stating air raid message yellow. This meant that aircraft had been detected heading in the direction of Coventry. Then came air raid message red, the signal to turn on the sirens. Coventry had experienced air raids before. The city had taken them in stride. But Thursday night felt different, as many residents later recalled. Suddenly, flares appeared in the sky, drifting under parachutes, further lighting streets already luminescent with moonglow. At 7:20, incendiary bombs began to fall, with what one witness described as a swishing sound, like heavy rain. Some of the incendiaries seemed to be a new variety. Instead of simply igniting and starting fires, they exploded, sending incendiary material in all directions. A number of high-explosive bombs fell as well, including 5 4,000-pound Satans, with the apparent intent of destroying water mains and keeping firefighting teams from getting to work. Then came the full rain of high-explosive bombs, as the pilots above bombed the fires. They dropped parachute mines as well, 127 in all, of which 20 failed to explode, either because of a malfunction or a time-delay fuse, something the Luftwaffe seemed to delight in deploying. The air was filled with the crash of guns, the whine of bombs and the terrific flash and bang as they exploded, recalled one police constable. The sky seemed to be full of planes. The raid came so suddenly, and with such strength, that a group of women at a YWCA hostel had no time to escape to a nearby shelter, For the first time in my life, one wrote, I knew what it was like to shake with fear. Bombs struck several shelters. Teams of soldiers and ARP men worked through the rubble by hand for fear of causing harm to survivors. One refuge had clearly been destroyed by a direct hit. After a time, we came to the occupants of the shelter, wrote one rescuer. Some were quite cold and others were still warm, but they were all dead. A bomb landed close to a shelter into which Dr. Evelyn Ashworth and her two children had retreated. First came a shattering noise, she wrote, then the blast, and a land wave which rocked the shelter. The blast blew off the shelter door. Her seven-year-old said, That nearly blew my hair off. Her three-year-old, It nearly blew my head off. At one city hospital, Dr. Harry Winter climbed to the roof to help extinguish incendiary bombs before they set the hospital on fire. I could hardly believe my eyes, he said. All round the hospital grounds glowed literally hundreds of incendiary bombs, like lights twinkling on a mammoth Christmas tree. Within the building, women in the maternity ward were placed under their beds, with mattresses over their bodies. One patient was a German airman, injured and convalescing in a bed on the top floor. Too much bomb, too long, he moaned. Too much bomb. Casualties began to arrive at the hospital. Dr. Winter and his fellow surgeons went to work in three operating theatres. Most of the injuries were damaged limbs and severe lacerations. The complications with bomb lacerations, however, is that you get a small wound on the surface, but extensive disruption underneath, Dr. Winter wrote later. Everything is pulped together. It's no use fixing the surface wound without doing a major cutting job on the inside. At another hospital, a nurse in training found herself confronting an old terror. During the course of my training, I had always the fear of being left with the limb of a patient in my hand after amputation, and had so far managed to be off duty when amputations were taking place, she wrote. The attack changed all that for me. I didn't have time to be squeamish. Now the city bore what many considered its most traumatic wound. Incendiaries salted the roofs and grounds of the city's famed Cathedral of St. Michael, the first descending at around 8 o'clock. One landed on the roof, which was made of lead. The fire burned through the metal, causing molten lead to fall onto the wooden interior below, igniting it as well. Witnesses called for fire trucks, but all of the trucks were engaged fighting fires throughout the city. The first truck to reach the cathedral arrived an hour and a half later, having come from the town of Solihull, 14 miles away. Its crew could do nothing but watch. A bomb had shattered a critical water main. An hour later, water at last began to flow, but with very low pressure, and soon that, too, waned to nothing. As the fire advanced and began consuming chancel and chapels and the heavy wood beams of the roof, church employees rushed inside to rescue all that they could. Tapestries, crosses, candlesticks, a wafer box, a crucifix, and brought them to the police station in a solemn procession. Reverend R.T. Howard, provost of the cathedral, watched it burn from the police station porch as an orange fist engulfed its ancient pipe organ, once played by Handel. The whole interior was a seething mass of flame, and piled up blazing beams and timbers, interpenetrated and surmounted with dense bronze-coloured smoke, Howard wrote. The rest of Coventry seemed to be on fire as well. The glow was visible 30 miles away, spotted, in fact, by Minister of Home Security Herbert Morrison, who was a guest at a distant country home. A German pilot shot down soon after the raid told RAF interrogators that he could see the glow 100 miles off as he flew over London on his return leg. In Balsall Common, 8 miles west of Coventry, diarist Clara Milburn wrote, When we went out, the searchlights were probing the clear sky. The stars looked very near. The air was so clear and the moonlight was brilliant. I have never seen such a glorious night. Wave after wave of aircraft came over and heavy gunfire followed. All through the night, for 11 hours, the bombers came, and incendiaries and bombs fell. Witnesses told of familiar odours raised from the flames that would have been comforting, if not for the cause. A fire consuming a tobacco store filled the surrounding area with the scent of cigar smoke and burning pipe tobacco. A burning butcher shop raised the aroma of roast meat and brought to mind the comforts of the traditional Sunday evening joint. The bombs fell until 6:15 a.m. The blackout ended at 7:54. The moon still shone in the clear dawn sky. But the bombers were gone. The cathedral was a ruin, with melted lead still dripping from its roofs, and fragments of charred timber now and then coming loose and falling to the ground. Throughout the city, the most common sound was that of broken glass crunching under people's shoes. One news reporter observed glass so thick that, looking up the street, it was as if it was covered with ice. Now came scenes of horror. Dr. Ashworth reported seeing a dog running along a street with a child's arm in its mouth. A man named E. A. Cox saw a man's headless body beside a bomb crater. Elsewhere, an exploded landmine left behind a collection of charred torsos. Bodies arrived at a makeshift morgue at a rate of up to 60 per hour, and here morticians had to deal with a problem they had rarely, if ever, been compelled to confront. Bodies so mangled that they were unrecognizable as bodies. Between 40% and 50% were classified as unidentifiable owing to mutilation. Those bodies that were mostly intact received luggage tags, stating where the body had been found and, when possible, the likely identification, and were stacked in multiple tiers. Survivors were permitted to walk through and look for missing friends and kin until a bomb struck an adjacent natural gas storage facility, causing an explosion that tore the roof off the morgue. Rain fell, distorting the luggage tags. The process of identification was so macabre, so fruitless, with sometimes three or four people identifying the same body, that visits were halted and identifications made by examining personal belongings collected from the dead. A sign went up outside the morgue stating, "It is greatly regretted that the pressure at the mortuary is such that it is not possible for relatives to view any of the bodies." Lord Beaverbrook hurried to the city, unwilling to be perceived as missing another cataclysmic raid. His visit was not well received. He focused on restoring production in factories damaged in the attack. During a meeting with officials, he tried out a bit of Churchillian rhetoric. "The roots of the Air Force are planted in Coventry," he said. "If Coventry's output is destroyed, the tree will languish. But if the city rises from the ashes, then the tree will continue to burgeon, putting forth fresh leaves and branches." He was said to have shed tears upon seeing the destruction, only to be brought up sharply, according to Lucy Moseley, the mayor's daughter. Tears, she wrote, had no value. Beaverbrook had hectored the factories for maximum production, and now much of the city was in ruins. "He'd asked Coventry's workers for an all-out effort," Moseley wrote, "and what had they got for it?" Minister of Home Security Herbert Morrison came too, and found himself blamed for failing to better protect the city and for the fact that the German bombers had arrived virtually without challenge by the RAF. And, indeed, the RAF, though it had made 121 sorties during the night, using dozens of fighters equipped with air-to-air radar, reported only two engagements and failed to destroy a single bomber, once again underscoring the persistent difficulty of fighting in darkness. Operation Cold Water took place, but with minimal effect. British bombers struck airfields in France and military targets in Berlin, losing 10 bombers in the process. The RAF's countermeasures group, No. 80 Wing, used jammers and beam-bending transmitters to distort and divert German beams, but these were thought to have had little effect, according to an Air Force analysis, since the night was so clear and bright that radio navigational aids were not essential. The unit did succeed in dispatching a pair of bombers to follow two German beams back to their home transmitters in Cherbourg, where they knocked both out of action. The failure to down any aircraft, however, prompted an angry telegram from the Air Ministry to Fighter Command, asking why there had been so few interceptions, despite fine weather, moonlight, and considerable fighter effort exerted. The city offered a much warmer welcome to the King, who arrived on Saturday morning for an unannounced visit. Mayor Moseley had learned of the impending honour only late the previous day. His wife, who was in the midst of gathering up the family's personal belongings for a move to a relative's home outside the city, burst into tears. These were not tears of joy. "Oh dear," she cried, "doesn't he understand we're in too much of a mess and have so much to do without him coming?" The King met first with the mayor in his formal mayor's parlour, now lighted only by candles stuck in the mouths of beer bottles. Afterward, accompanied by other officials, The two men set out to tour the devastation, and soon, without warning, the king began turning up in the most prosaic locales. At one stop, a stunned group of weary, elderly people jumped to their feet and sang God Save the King. Elsewhere, a worker who had sat down on a curb for a brief rest, grubby and tired, still wearing his helmet, looked up to see men approaching on the street. As the group passed, its apparent leader said, "Good morning," and nodded. Only after they moved on did the man on the curb realize it was the king. I was so taken aback, flabbergasted, amazed, overwhelmed, that I couldn't even answer him. At the cathedral, the king was introduced to Provost Howard. "The king's arrival took me completely by surprise," Howard wrote. He heard cheering and saw the king enter through a door at the southwest end of the church. Howard greeted him. They shook hands. "I stood with him, watching the ruins," Howard wrote. His whole attitude was one of intense sympathy and grief. A team of mass observation researchers, experienced in chronicling the effects of air raids, had arrived on Friday afternoon. In their subsequent report, they wrote of having found more open signs of hysteria, terror, neurosis, than they had seen over the prior 2 months of chronicling air raid effects. The overwhelmingly dominant feeling on Friday was the feeling of utter helplessness. The italics were theirs. The observers noted a widespread sense of dislocation and depression. "The dislocation is so total in the town that people feel that the town itself is killed." In order to help stem the surge of rumours arising from the raid, the BBC invited Tom Harrison, the 29-year-old director of mass observation, to do a broadcast on Saturday night at 9 o'clock, during its prime home service news slot, to talk about what he had seen in the city. "The strangest sight of all," Harrison told his vast audience, "was the cathedral. At each end, the bare frames of the great windows still have a kind of beauty without their glass. But in between them is an incredible chaos of bricks, pillars, girders, memorial tablets." He spoke of the absolute silence in the city on Friday night as he drove around it in his car, threading his way past bomb craters and mounds of broken glass. He slept in the car that night. "I think this is one of the weirdest experiences of my whole life," he said, driving in a lonely, silent desolation and drizzling rain in that great industrial town. The broadcast became a topic of earnest conversation at the Monday, November 18th meeting of Churchill's War Cabinet. Anthony Eden, Secretary of State for War, soon to become Foreign Secretary, called it a most depressing broadcast. Others agreed and wondered whether it would dampen public morale. Churchill, however, argued that, on balance, the broadcast had done little harm and might even have done some good by drawing attention to the attack among listeners in the United States. This proved to be the case in New York, where the Herald Tribune described the bombing as an insane barbarity and proclaimed, "No means of defense which the United States can place in British hands should be withheld." In Germany, senior officials were anything but alarmed by the publicity given the attack on Coventry. Goebbels called it an exceptional success. In his diary entry for Sunday, November 17th, he wrote, "The reports from Coventry are horrendous. An entire city, literally, wiped out. The English are no longer pretending. All they can do now is wail. But they asked for it." He saw nothing negative in the worldwide attention the attack had drawn, and in fact thought the raid could signal a turning point. "This affair has aroused the greatest attention all over the world. Our stock is on the rise again," he wrote in his diary on Monday, November 18th. "The USA is succumbing to gloom, and the usual arrogant tone has disappeared from the London press. All we need is a few weeks of good weather. Then England could be dealt with." Luftwaffe Chief Göring hailed the raid as a historic victory. Adolf Galland's commander, Field Marshal Kesselring, lauded the exceptionally good results. Kesselring shrugged off the mass of civilian deaths as simply a cost of war. "The unpredictable consequences of even a precision bombing attack are much to be regretted," he wrote later, "but are inseparable from any attack in force." For some Luftwaffe pilots, however, the raid seemed to have crossed a line. "The usual cheers that greeted a direct hit stuck in our throats," wrote one bomber pilot. "The crew just gazed down on the sea of flames in silence. Was this really a military target?" In all, The Coventry raid killed 568 civilians and seriously wounded another 865. Of the 509 bombers ultimately dispatched by Göring to attack the city, some were deterred by anti-aircraft fire, others turned back for other reasons. 449 actually made it. Over 11 hours, Luftwaffe crews dropped 500 tons of high explosives and 29,000 incendiaries. The raid destroyed 2,294 buildings and damaged 45,704 more, such thorough devastation that it gave rise to a new word, Coventration, to describe the effect of massed air raids. The RAF made Coventry the standard by which to estimate the total of deaths likely to occur during its own raids on German towns, with the results rated as one Coventry, two Coventries, and so on. The sheer volume of bodies, many still unidentified, caused city officials to forbid individual burials. The first mass funeral and burial for 172 victims was held on Wednesday, November 20th. The second, for 250 more, took place 3 days later. There were no public calls for reprisals against Germany. At the first of the funerals, the Bishop of Coventry said, "Let us vow before God to be better friends and neighbours in the future, because we have suffered this together and have stood here today." Chapter 60. Distraction. John Colville was entranced. Bombs fell and cities burned, but there was his love life to attend to. As he endured the persistent aloofness of his yearned-for, gay Margessen, he found himself increasingly drawn to 18-year-old Audrey Paget. On Sunday, November 17th, a brilliant fall day, the two went riding on the expansive grounds of the Paget family's estate, Hatfield Park, roughly an hour's drive north of central London. He described the afternoon in his diary. "Mounted on two spirited and good-looking horses, Audrey and I rode for 2 hours in brilliant sunshine, galloping through Hatfield Park, walking through the woods and bracken, careening wildly over fields and ditches, and all the time I found it hard to take my eyes off Audrey, whose slim figure, sweetly disordered hair and flushed cheeks, made her seem a woodland nymph too lovely for the world of reality." He was torn. "Actually," he wrote the next day, "if I were not in love with Gay, and if I thought Audrey would marry me, which she certainly would not just at present, I should not at all mind having a wife so beautiful, so vivacious, and whom I genuinely like as well as admire. But still, Gay, with all her faults, is Gay, and it would be silly to get married, even if I could, at this moment of European history." For Pamela Churchill, there was mounting anxiety about money. On Tuesday, November 19th, she wrote to her husband, Randolph, to ask him to pay her an additional £10 a week in allowance, roughly $640 today. "I enclose a sketch of the expenses here, which I hope you will look into carefully," she wrote. "I don't want to be mean and beastly, but, my darling, I am doing everything I can to run your home and look after your son economically, but I can't do the impossible." She listed all the family's expenses, down to the cost of cigarettes and drinks. Together, these consumed nearly all the income she received from Randolph and from other sources, namely the rent her sister-in-law Diana paid and an allowance from her own family. These, however, were merely the expenses she could anticipate with reasonable accuracy. Her deep fear was about Randolph's spending and his weakness for alcohol and gambling. "So try and limit your expenses to £5 a week in Scotland," she wrote. "And, darling, surely you're not ashamed of saying you're too poor to gamble. I know you love baby Winston and me and won't mind making a sacrifice for us." She cautioned that it was vital for them to get control of their expenditures. "I simply can't be happy when I'm sick with worry all the time," she wrote. She was by now deeply disappointed in her marriage, but not yet irrevocably. She softened her tone. "Oh, my darling Randy," she wrote, "I wouldn't worry if I didn't love you so deeply and so desperately. Thank you for making me your wife and for letting me have your son. It is the most wonderful thing that has happened in my life." Churchill's weekend stays at Chequers and Ditchley provided him with invaluable opportunities for distraction. They took him away from the increasingly dreary streetscape of London, where each day another fragment of Whitehall was incinerated or blown away. During one weekend at Ditchley, his full moon refuge, he and his guests watched a film in the mansion's home cinema, Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator. Late the next night, exhausted, Churchill mistimed his landing on a chair and fell between it and an ottoman, wedging himself with his rear on the floor and his feet in the air. Colville witnessed the moment. "Having no false dignity," Colville wrote, "he treated it as a complete joke and repeated several times, 'A real Charlie Chaplin.'" The weekend of November 30th brought two particularly welcome diversions. That day, Saturday, the family gathered at Chequers to celebrate Churchill's 66th birthday. The next, the christening of Pamela and Randolph Churchill's new son, Winston. The child was round and robust, and from early on struck Private Secretary John Martin as being absurdly like his grandfather, which prompted one of Churchill's daughters to quip, "So are all babies." First came a service at the little parish church in nearby Ellsborough, where Clementine was a regular attendee. This was Churchill's first visit. Their three daughters came, Mary despite a sore throat, as did the baby's four godparents, among them Lord Beaverbrook and reporter Virginia Coles, a close friend of Randolph's. Churchill wept throughout the service, now and then saying softly, "Poor infant, to be born into such a world as this." Then came lunch back at the house, attended by the family, the godparents, and the church rector. Beaverbrook stood up to propose a toast to the child. But Churchill rose immediately and said, "As it was my birthday yesterday, I am going to ask you all to drink to my health first." A wave of good-natured protest rose from the guests, as did shouts of, "Sit down, Daddy!" Churchill resisted, then took his seat. After the toasts to the baby, Beaverbrook raised a glass to honour Churchill, calling him the greatest man in the world. Again, Churchill wept. A call went up for his reply. He stood. As he spoke, his voice shook and tears streamed. "In these days," he said, "I often think of our Lord." He could say no more. He sat down and looked at no one, the great orator made speechless by the weight of the day. Coles found herself deeply moved. "I have never forgotten those simple words. And if he enjoyed waging the war, let it be remembered that he understood the anguish of it as well." The next day, apparently in need of a little attention himself, Beaverbrook resigned again. Beaverbrook wrote the letter on Monday, December 2nd, from his country home, Chartley, where I am alone and where I have had time to think about the direction which I believe our policy should take. Further dispersal of aircraft factories was vital, he wrote, and required an aggressive new push, though this would certainly mean a temporary decline in production. "This bold policy," he warned, "means much interference with other ministries, on account of the need for suitable premises already earmarked for other services." But then he wrote, "I am not now the man for the job. I will not get the necessary support." Once again he veered toward self-pity, citing how his reputation had diminished as the fighter crisis had begun to ease. "In fact, when the reservoir was empty, I was a genius," he wrote. "Now that the reservoir has some water in it, I am an inspired brigand. If ever the water slops over, I will be a bloody anarchist." Someone new must now take over, he said. He made a couple of recommendations. He suggested that Churchill explain his resignation to others as having been prompted by ill health, which, I regret to say, is more than justified. As always, he ended with flattery, applying what he often called the oil can. He wrote, "I cannot conclude this very important letter without emphasizing that my success in the past has come from your support. Without that backing, without that inspiration, without that leadership, I could never have accomplished the tasks and duties you set me." Churchill knew that Beaverbrook's asthma had flared anew. He felt sympathy for his friend, but he was losing patience. "There is no question of my accepting your resignation," he wrote the next day, Tuesday, December 3rd. "As I told you, you are in the galleys and will have to row on to the end." He suggested that Beaverbrook take a month to recuperate. "Meanwhile, I will certainly support you in carrying out your dispersal policy, which seems imperative under the heavy attacks to which we are subjected," Churchill wrote. He told Beaverbrook that he regretted the return of his asthma, "because it always brings great depression in its train. You know how often you have advised me not to let trifles vex and distract me. Now let me repay the service by begging you to remember only the greatness of the work you have achieved, the vital need of its continuance, and the goodwill of your old and faithful friend, Winston Churchill." Beaverbrook returned to the galleys and took up his oar once again. In the midst of it all, everyone got sick. A cold raced through the family. Mary sensed its onset on Monday night, December 2nd. "Have temperature," she wrote in her diary. "Oh, hell." Churchill caught her cold or another on December 9th. Clementine on December 12th. Bombs fell all the same. Chapter 61. Special Delivery. British forces at last won a victory, this against the Italian army in Libya, but merchant ships carrying crucial supplies continued to sink at an alarming rate, English cities to burn. The nation's financial crisis worsened daily, prompting Churchill to compose a long letter to President Roosevelt about the gravity of Britain's position and what it needed from America if it was to prevail. In writing the letter, which totaled 15 pages, Churchill once again had to find the right balance of confidence and need, as captured in the minutes of a meeting of his war cabinet. The Prime Minister said that if the picture was painted too darkly, elements in the United States would say that it was useless to help us, for such help would be wasted and thrown away. If too bright a picture was painted, then there might be a tendency to withhold assistance. "The whole thing," Churchill grumbled on Friday, December 6th, "was a bloody business." Later, and with good reason, Churchill would call this letter to Roosevelt one of the most important he had ever written. That Saturday, December 7th, at Chequers, Churchill convened a secret meeting to try to come up with a definitive estimate of German airstrength and Germany's capacity for producing more planes in the future. Deeming the matter to be of utmost importance, he invited the Prof, War Cabinet Secretary Bridges, and five others, including members of the Ministry of Economic Warfare, MEW, and the intelligence arm of the Air Staff. Churchill did not invite Pug Ismay, however, in order to give him a rest. On Pug's part, a rare absence. For more than 4 hours, the group debated available statistics and intelligence, and succeeded only in confirming that no one had a precise sense of how many aircraft the Luftwaffe possessed, let alone how many were available for frontline action and how many more could be manufactured in the coming year. Even more frustrating, no one seemed to know how many aircraft the RAF itself was able to marshal. The two agencies, MEW and Air Intelligence, came up with different numbers and different approaches to calculating these figures, a confusion compounded by the Prof's sallies into both sets of estimates. Churchill was vexed. "I have not been able to reach a conclusion as to which are right," he wrote in a minute to Air Minister Sinclair and Chief of the Air Staff, Portal. "Probably the truth lies midway between them. The subject is of capital importance to the whole future picture we make to ourselves of the war." Most galling was that his own air ministry appeared to be unable to account for 3,500 airplanes out of 8,500 frontline and reserve aircraft believed ready, or nearly ready, for service. "Surely there is, in the air ministry, an account kept of what happens to every machine," Churchill complained in a subsequent minute. "These are very expensive articles. We must know the date when each one was received by the RAF and when it was finally struck off, and for what reason." After all, he noted, even automaker Rolls-Royce kept track of each car it sold. A discrepancy of 3,500 in 8,500 is glaring. The summit convinced Churchill that the issue could be resolved only by the intercession of a clear-eyed outsider. He decided to subject the matter to the equivalent of a court trial, complete with a judge, to hear evidence from all parties involved. He selected Sir John Singleton, a justice of the King's Bench Division who was best known for presiding over the 1936 trial of Buck Ruxton in the notorious Bodies Under the Bridge case, in which Ruxton was convicted of killing his wife and housemaid and butchering them into more than 70 pieces, most of these later found in a bundle under a bridge. The case was also known as the Jigsaw Murders, an allusion to the heroic forensic effort to piece together the victims' bodies. Both sides agreed that recruiting Mr. Justice Singleton was a wise thing to do, and Singleton accepted the task, perhaps allowing himself to imagine that this endeavour would be a lot more straightforward than assembling mutilated corpses. In London, the toll on lovely things mounted. On the night of Sunday, December 8th, a bomb destroyed the cloisters in St. Stephen's Chapel in Westminster Palace, one of Churchill's favourite places. The next day, Parliamentary Secretary Chips Channon came upon Churchill walking among the ruins. Churchill had spent the weekend at Chequers, but had come back to the city despite his incipient cold. He wore a coat with a fur collar. A cigar jutted from his mouth. He picked his way through shattered glass and mounds of debris. "It's horrible," he said mushily around the cigar. "They would hit the best bit," Channon said. Churchill grunted, "where Cromwell signed King Charles's death warrant." That Monday, Churchill's long letter to Roosevelt, sent by cable to Washington, reached the president aboard a U.S. Navy cruiser. The Tuscaloosa was in the midst of a 10-day voyage through the Caribbean, ostensibly to visit the British West Indies bases to which the U.S. Navy now had access, but mainly as a chance for the president to relax, to rest in the sun, watch movies, and fish. Ernest Hemingway sent him a message saying that large fish could be found in the waters between Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic, and recommending that he use pork rind as bait. Churchill's letter arrived in a Navy seaplane, which landed near the ship to deliver the latest White House mail. "As we reach the end of this year," the letter began, "I feel you will expect me to lay before you the prospects for 1941. Churchill made it clear that where he most needed assistance was in maintaining the flow of food and military supplies to England, and emphasized that whether the nation endured or not could also determine the fate of America. He saved the crux of the problem for last. "The moment approaches when we shall no longer be able to pay cash for shipping and other supplies." In closing, he urged Roosevelt to regard this letter not as an appeal for aid, but as a statement of the minimum action necessary to achieve our common purpose. Churchill, of course, did want American aid, masses of it, ships, planes, bullets, machine parts, food. He simply didn't want to have to pay for it, and indeed was fast running out of the means to do so. 3 days later, on Thursday, December 12th, Churchill's ambassador to America, Lord Lothian, abruptly died of uremic poisoning. He was 58 years old. A Christian Scientist, he had been ill for 2 days but had declined medical aid, which prompted Foreign Secretary Halifax to write, "Another victim for Christian Science. He will be very difficult to replace." Wrote Diana Cooper, "Orange aid and Christian Science quite vanquished him. An untimely end indeed." Churchill travelled to Chequers that day. Lothian's death cast the house into an intemperate gloom. Only Mary and John Colville joined him for dinner. Clementine, suffering a migraine and a sore throat, skipped the meal and went to bed. The atmosphere was not helped by a soup course that Churchill found so inadequate that it launched him into the kitchen in a fury, his brilliantly hued dressing gown flapping over his light blue siren suit. Wrote Mary in her diary, "Papa in very bad mood over food, and of course I couldn't control him, and he was very naughty and rushed out and complained to the cook about the soup, which he truthfully said was tasteless. I feared the domestic apple cart may have been upset. Oh dear." At length, after listening to her father expound on the poor quality of food at Chequers, Mary left the table. Churchill and Colville remained. Gradually, Churchill's mood improved. Over brandy, he savoured the recent Libyan victory and talked as if the end of the war were near. Colville went to bed at 1:20 a.m. Earlier that night, in London, Churchill's war cabinet had met in great secrecy to consider a new tactic in the RAF's strategy for bombing targets in Germany, which Churchill had endorsed as a response to the Luftwaffe's massed attack on Coventry and subsequent intense raids against Birmingham and Bristol. The goal was to deliver the same kind of obliterative assault, a crash concentration against a German city. The cabinet determined that such an attack would rely mainly on fire and should target a densely built town that had not been previously raided by the RAF, thereby ensuring that its civil defence services would be inexperienced. High explosive bombs were to be used to produce craters that would hamper the response of fire crews. Since we aimed at affecting the enemy's morale, we should attempt to destroy the greater part of a particular town, the cabinet minutes said. The town chosen should therefore not be too large. The cabinet approved the plan, which received the code name Abigail. As John Colville noted in his diary the next day, Friday, December 13th, the moral scruples of the cabinet on this subject have been overcome. Roosevelt had received Churchill's letter aboard the Tuscaloosa. He read it, but kept his impression of it to himself. Even Harry Hopkins, his friend and confidant, who was travelling with him aboard the Tuscaloosa, could not gauge his reaction. Hopkins, in failing health, caught a 20-pound grouper, but was too weak to reel it in, and had to pass his fishing rod to another passenger. "I didn't know for quite a while what he was thinking about, if anything," Hopkins said, "but then I began to get the idea that he was refueling, the way he so often does when he seems to be resting and carefree, so I didn't ask him any questions. Then, one evening, he suddenly came out with it, the whole program." Chapter 62. Directive. Mass Observation sent out its December directive, asking its many diarists to express their feelings about the coming year. "How do I feel about 1941? Wrote diarist Olivia Cockett. "I stopped typing for 2 minutes to listen to an extra noisy enemy plane. It dropped the bomb, which puffed my curtains in and made the house shiver. I am in bed under the roof, and now the guns are galumphing at its back. There are craters at the bottom of my garden and a small unexploded bomb. 4 windows are broken. Can see the ruins of 18 houses within 5 minutes' walk. Have 2 lots of friends staying with us, whose homes have been wrecked. About 1941, I feel that I shall be damned glad if I'm lucky enough to see it at all, and that I'd rather like to see it." At root, she felt cheerful, she wrote. "But I think differently. Think we'll be hungrier. Haven't been hungry yet. Think many of our young men will die abroad.